Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the April 7th meeting of the House Fraud Prevention and State Oversight Committee. We're glad to have you here. I hope you all had a good weekend. Looks like we do have a quorum, so we're going to go ahead and approve the minutes from the March 24th meeting. Representative Hudson, would you move the minutes from March 24th?
I will, Madam Chair.
Great. Representative Hudson moves the minutes from March 24th. Is there any discussion? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. Members, we have a great presentation today on how the state used the COVID money that we received during the pandemic from the federal government and then state appropriations that came on top of that. And first up, we are going to have the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget and her staff join us. So please welcome to the committee, Commissioner Campbell, and you guys can get set up. I believe you have some slides. And members, there's a deck in your packet as well. And just go ahead, state your name for the record. We're glad you're here. Look forward to your testimony.
All right, well, good morning. For the record, I'm Erin Campbell. I'm the Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you, Chair Robbins and committee members, for the opportunity to present today on the funds the state received in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm proud to report that both the Coronavirus Relief Fund and the American Rescue Plan received unmodified opinions or clean audit reports for our single audit for all years to date with no material weaknesses or required repayments. More recently, I'm especially grateful for our team's efforts to help Minnesota townships complete final reporting and avoid returning nearly $1.5 million to the U.S. Treasury. This spring marks 5 years since the initial response efforts began here in Minnesota and have since claimed the lives of more than 17,000 Minnesotans and over a million Americans. From emergency health measures to economic stabilization, every level of government was called on to act quickly, decisively, and at an unprecedented scale. You will see more than $76 billion in federal funds came to Minnesota in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. $13 billion of this went through our state government. This presentation is intended as a broad overview of the pandemic-related funds that came to Minnesota and will be followed by a deeper dive on unemployment insurance from this time. At the committee's interest, additional agency-specific presentations could follow at a future hearing. With that, I'd invite our State Budget Director, Anna Mingi, to continue with the presentation.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Anna Mingi, Assistant Commissioner and State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. As the Commissioner noted, I'm here today to provide an overview of the federal funding the state has received in response to COVID-19. So to sort of level set the universe of funding that we generally consider when we talk about federal COVID funds, we're largely talking about funding appropriated in five bills passed by Congress that have provided funds to states to respond to COVID. I'm going to walk through them fairly quickly without going into significant detail about their contents, but to give you a sort of refresh all of our memories and give an overview of the sort of timing of events. The first bill, the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriations Bill, passed on March 6, 2020. The bill was relatively small, providing $8.3 billion in emergency funds, focusing largely on public health response. Later in March, Congress passed the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which provided paid sick leave, tax credits, and free COVID-19 testing. It expanded food assistance and unemployment, and increased Medicaid funding. The bulk of the funding that the state has received, however, has been from the last three bills on this list. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, more commonly referred to as the CARES Act, was a $2 trillion stimulus bill. It provided loans and grants to businesses, expanded unemployment aid, provided direct payments to families, supported healthcare providers, and provided funding to state and local governments. Then in December of 2020, The Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act, which is also known as the Consolidated Appropriations Act, passed and provided about $900 million for pandemic-related economic relief. This included about $325 billion for small businesses, $166 billion for additional stimulus payments, funding for increased UI benefits, schools and universities, vaccines, and many other programs. And finally, the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, passed in March of 2021 with an estimate of about $1.9 trillion. It contained a variety of funding for economic relief, education, public health, and local government. So with that backdrop, then let's pivot to how much money did Minnesota receive through these COVID relief bills. This slide provides an overview of all of the federal funds flowing into Minnesota through these federal relief bills, dividing those dollars into what came to state government for administration versus those that flowed directly to other recipients. This information comes from an organization called Federal Funds Information for States, or FFIS. And in total, FFIS estimates that Minnesota will receive about $76 billion in federal COVID relief funding. Of that, $13 billion has come to state government, while about $63 billion has flowed to other recipients. We'll discuss more of the state programs in detail, but I wanted to highlight some notable funding provided to other recipients. So of the $63 billion, you can see the line labeled economic assistance, and that's about $52 million, or almost 80% of the money flowing to non-state recipients. This includes about $17 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program, which was a federal program implemented by the Small Business Administration. It allowed businesses to apply for a low-interest loan, which was partially or fully forgiven if a business kept employee counts and wages stable. Also in that $52 billion for economic assistance funding to other recipients is about $14 billion in economic impact payments, what we commonly think of as stimulus payments. There were three rounds from the CARES Act, the CRISA, and ARPA. And then another notable funding stream flowing outside of state government, you can see on the Health and Human Services line, was about $2.2 billion provided to healthcare providers through a funding stream known as the Provider Relief Fund. So with that, I think the remainder of my presentation will focus largely on the funds flowing to state government. Looking at the graph on slide, the image on slide four, you can see that the relative distribution of the funds that the state has received. About $3.9 billion of the total has been received through some flexible funding mechanisms, specifically the Coronavirus Relief Fund from the CARES Act and the State Fiscal Recovery Fund from the American Rescue Plan. Health and Human Services is the next largest category of spending, roughly $3.8 billion. The largest items in that category of funds are over $2 billion in enhanced Medicaid matching funds, and then not surprisingly significant public health funding to support the response to COVID-19. So with that overview, now I'm going to walk through some of the larger funding streams incorporated in these numbers, starting with our flexible resources. As you just saw, flexible funds have played a significant role in the state's COVID response. The first allocation of flexible funds came to the state through the Coronavirus Relief Fund. Minnesota received $2.2 billion in the Coronavirus Relief Fund through the CARES Act. Of that, $1.16 billion went to local governments, and just over $1 billion came to the state. So in order for an expenditure to be an eligible use of the Coronavirus Relief Fund, or as an abbreviation, the CRF, it needed to be a necessary expenditure incurred due to the public health emergency, but not previously budgeted for by the state. The table here illustrates how we spent the state's allocation. Almost a quarter of our award funded activities to support education during the pandemic. There was also significant spending for testing, support for at-risk populations, business relief, and other response activities. There is much more information about the state's CRF spending available on MMB's website. We have both summary reports as well as the request forms that were submitted to the Legislative Advisory Commission for review. And in terms of timeline, the CRF was really for activities from March of 2020 through the end of calendar year 2022. So then the next source of flexible funds received by the state was the American Rescue Plan State Fiscal Recovery Fund on slide six. The State Fiscal Recovery Fund allows for broad uses, including revenue replacement, for expenditures obligated between March 2021 and December of 2024. Notably, the funds couldn't be used for tax cuts, debt service, or pensions, or as a state match to draw down some other federal funds. For example, we couldn't use State Fiscal Recovery Funds as a state match for a Medicaid expenditure. Minnesota received $2.8 billion, and of that, $2.3 billion, roughly 80%, was appropriated by the legislature to replenish the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Due to significant layoffs early in the COVID-19 pandemic, the state's UI Trust Fund relied on an advance from the federal government to continue operations and benefits. Generally, the fund is replenished through increases in taxes and assessments paid into the UI Trust Fund. But through this federal funding and an additional general fund appropriation, replenishing the fund and paying back federal advances, the state avoided some of those increased costs to employers. The state also, the remainder of the $2.8 billion was appropriated from the State Fiscal Recovery Fund for COVID immediate response through a mechanism named in state law the COVID-19 Flexible Response Account, which paid for things like summer learning, emergency healthcare staffing, workforce stabilization, and childcare. And similar to the CRF, we have many reports on our website laying out the allocations from the COVID Flexible Response Account. So in addition to state government, local governments also receive significant flexible funds totaling about $3.3 billion. About $1.4 billion of that was allocated to cities and towns, and about $1.9 billion has gone to counties. Now, pivoting back to the funding that the state has received, as you saw in the earlier slides, education was a significant area of federal investment. About $2.1 billion of the total has come to the state through two programs known by their acronyms as ESSER and GEAR. ESSER stands for the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief. It was about $2.1 billion that came to the state, and of that, 90% was formula funds distributed to districts based on Title I allocations, and the remaining 10% was allocated in state grants. The funding went towards activities that addressed learning loss as a result of the pandemic, as well as funds to respond to COVID-19, including maintenance of operations and staffing. Things like COVID response, training staff on sanitation supplies, planning for closure, education technology, mental health supports, and things like improving air quality systems. MDE also had some flexibility over that remaining 10%, and some of the ways that they allocated flexible funds included after-school programs, summer enrichment, multi-tiered systems of support for schools, expanding rigorous coursework, and public engagement with schools. In addition, Minnesota received $105 million through the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Program, commonly referred to by its acronym of GEAR, which has been used to provide school-aged care, technology access, mental health training, and response. So in addition to significant education funding, the state has received significant funds to support the child care sector. The Department of Human Services received about $720 million in child care specific funds, and 709 of that came through two large grant programs. The first I'd highlight is $324 million in child care stabilization funds. These funds supported provider stabilization and workforce development grants, as well as training programs and other provider supports. The remainder came through increases to the Child Care Development Block Grant. The Child Care Development Block Grant, sometimes called CCDBG, is an ongoing funding source that the state receives from the federal government. However, in COVID, we received sort of a bump up in the amount of funds that we received. This increase was used to increase rates in the child care assistance program, to make grants to providers, and buy down the wait list for the basic sliding fee program. I'd highlight that in addition to these child care specific funds, Minnesota has used over $125 million of our flexible funds to support the child care industry. Not surprisingly, we have also received a significant amount of federal funding to support public health response. These activities largely conducted within the Department of Health. About $983 million in federal funds was awarded to Minnesota from a variety of federal funding bills. It paid for things like community and school testing, vaccine preparedness, and local and state public health capacity building. Minnesota has also been awarded, we also spent $193 million of the Coronavirus Relief Fund and $75 million from our ARPA flexible allocation. So those are our two big flexible pots for COVID testing and vaccine response. FEMA has also funded vaccination, contact tracing, testing, and other direct response for over $300 million. Now, this is sort of an evolving area of our COVID funds. While most of our funds have been spent, there is some that under the terms of the legislation and the award, there is extended ability to spend, and some of the CDC grants have had the ability to be spent through June of 2026. However, on March 25th of this year, just a couple weeks ago, we were notified by the federal government that more than $220 million of those grants would be canceled effective immediately. The Department of Health had to take some really immediate measures to stop spending of those dollars. There is currently a temporary restraining order against that grant cancellation. However, we are monitoring the situation closely to understand how it will play out. The final sort of specific funding stream that I wanted to share with you all is some enhanced Medicaid match, because that represents some of the most significant funding that flowed to the state as a result of these COVID funding bills. First is a 6.2 enhanced federal matching rate for state medical assistance, otherwise called MA, which is our Medicaid program, for spending from January of 2020 through March of 2023, which then was followed by a gradual phase down for April through December of 2023. The match came with requirements to not disenroll individuals except in specific circumstances. So in total, the state received about $2.9 billion in this enhanced 6.2% match, but the costs of what we call the continuous coverage provisions of not disenrolling folks was about $1.4 billion, resulting in a net savings of about $1.5 billion from fiscal year 2020 through 2025. There was another enhanced Medicaid matching rate in the American Rescue Plan Act, which provided a 10% increase on federal matching rate for home and community-based services from April 1st of 2021 to March 31st of 2022. States were required to use these dollars to expand, strengthen, or enhance HCBS services during the time period of April 1st, 2021 through March 31st of 2024. Minnesota received about $667 million through this provision, and the state reinvested this amount in services and supports. It funded a combination of rate increases, service expansions, and supports to people to live in their own homes, as well as some system reforms. I'd note that for the Home and Community-Based Services FMAP, that 10% bump, the expenditures of those dollars were something that were a part of the 2021 biennial budget, so worked appropriated by the legislature and directed by the legislature. So like all federal funds, federal COVID funds are included in the single audit every year. MMB has served as the lead agency on the audit of the two large flexible funds, the ARPA State Fiscal Recovery and the Coronavirus Relief Fund. As you heard from the commissioner, we have received clean audit reports for both of these programs in all years, and no material weaknesses in internal controls were identified. So So in preparing for this presentation, we're aware that that you are interested in the status of unobligated and unspent COVID funds. As I sort of alluded to earlier, many funds in the COVID funding bills were appropriated with the ability to spend into future years and for uses that were broader than specific COVID response. All of our major COVID era grants have been fully obligated with the federal government, meaning that there is an agreement with an approved use plan. There are several agencies that are still spending federal COVID funds. I'll discuss some of those on the next slide. But as I mentioned before, in recent weeks, the federal government has canceled some of our existing agreements for work underway at the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. A court has temporarily blocked the cancellation, but we are monitoring that closely to see how it evolves. I would note, in general, if the federal funding bills that provide funds for a specific purpose dictate the time period they're allowed to be spent on and the allowable activities. If a state agency or a local government or other recipient in this case isn't able to spend all of the funds by the time established in the law, they are returned to the federal government. They don't stay with the state. So as I just mentioned, some COVID funds have the ability to be spent on broader uses for many years into the future. This slide shows the vast majority of funding streams with some ongoing activities, as well as the deadline for spending them. I won't walk through line by line, but I'll highlight a couple. The second line, the Capital Projects Fund, is a federal award being spent across the Department of Education and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. In this case, DEED has significant contracts underway for broadband development, and MDE has almost $50 million in the final stages of grant awards for multipurpose community facility projects, which I believe they anticipate to announce shortly. We also have, on two lines down from that, the health line, about $230 million in unspent CDC funds of the Department of Health through the grant program called the Epidemiology and Laboratory Capacity Grants, which folks often just call ELC grants. And those are the funds they were under the law available to be spent through June 30th of 2026. And this is the one of the programs where the fundings was canceled by the federal government on March 25th of 2025 and is pending a temporary restraining order. The cancellation of those MDH grants required MDH to take some immediate actions to stop the work that was underway, including asking grantees to stop their work, as well as issuing layoff notices to about 170 staff. But we are monitoring the legal work there closely. The Human Services line for our Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration block grants had about $30 million unspent but obligated, and in this case they were they're also canceled by the federal government on March 25th, but are pending legal action. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to take any questions from the committee.
Thank you so much for your presentation. We really appreciate it. I have several questions, as my colleagues are already lining up here. So I'm just going to start with a couple things that I think will be really quick, and then we'll have a broader conversation first. In this list on your last slide, page 14, of the COVID grants with unspent funds, could you send us a detailed list of that in each budget area or however it's laid out? I think that would be really helpful to all of us to understand what potential other cuts could be coming if the federal government claws it back early, and also what's still unobligated out there. And you know, I think as we're all in budget negotiations in our other committees, that's good information to have. Secondly, on that slide, the Small Business Credit Initiative, it says $97 million was awarded. The first tranche received was $30 million, and of that, $5.9 is unobligated. And maybe, you know, when your DEED colleagues come up, we can have them revisit this as well if it's not your area. But I just wondered what happened to the money that was awarded but not received? Is that still out there somewhere? Because that's a lot of money. Or is that already not in play?
Madam Chair, I see my colleague walking up.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Devin Bowdry, Government Relations Director. For the State Small Business Credit Initiative, we've received, as it says, the first tranche. And as we spend down, I think once we spend close to like 80% of that first tranche, then we can receive the second. And then same with the third. So we're expecting to receive it in three batches.
And you're still expecting to receive it even though the federal emergency is long over and they're taking money back. So you still think that money is coming?
Madam Chair, yes, at this point.
All right. Excellent. Thank you. To my colleagues, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the same vein, I'm trying to get my arms around, maybe it's here and I'm just not seeing it, but are all of the funds that the administration is trying to claw back, of all of those funds, how much of those funds have been both appropriated and obligated? Because it's pretty unprecedented for an administration to claw back funds or not honor grants that have been both appropriated and obligated.
Ms. Vinge.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, so the funds that are being clawed back are obligated with the federal government, meaning there is this approved use plan. I would agree that in general, historically we don't see significant clawbacks of funds where we have, you know, sort of an agreement with the federal government. In our review of sort of past rescissions and impoundment, it's generally before, happens, you know, after congressional appropriation, but before an improvement is signed, which is not to say that cancellation of a federal grant it has never happened, but this is fairly unusual and unprecedented.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If you wouldn't mind going back to slide 12, I have another question there. So I appreciate that the audits have been clean, and I think in general there's been a lot of good work done by the state in a lot of areas getting the COVID money out the door. But that being said, we also have had unprecedented fraud in particularly the Feeding Our Future and in childcare programs. So is any of the, my understanding was the Feeding Our Future money was federal COVID money. So how do you square this circle?
Madam Chair, the funds that we're talking about specifically here are those two big flexible pots, the Coronavirus Relief Fund and the ARPA State Fiscal Recovery Funds, the funds that were within sort of, that were MMB is the lead agency, leads the audit process. And with the specifics of, you know, Feeding Our Future, I defer to sort of others, including my colleagues at the Department of Education. But so it's just to say this is not a comprehensive list of all of the federal grants.
I appreciate that clarification. So just to be very clear, it's a clean audit on the flexible funds that you received, but not the broader scope of federal dollars we received. Because in your earlier statement, Commissioner Campbell, I think you said total we got $1.6 trillion in the state somewhere. What was in your opening line, there was a number I didn't jot down quickly.
Madam Chair, I'm looking to see. So I think you might be talking about the $1.5 million related to Minnesota townships complete.
No, I don't think so.
But in Minnesota received $76 billion in federal funds, and about $13 billion came through state government. So the single audit, the scope of the single audit does not, it is pretty prescribed, and it doesn't include all of those funds. So when we speak to the unmodified or clean audit reports for a single audit, we can get you what the scope is for those, the single audits, what's included and what's not. But it would not include, for instance, Feeding Our Futures. As you likely know, the OLA has done a number of audits of probably like 6 to 8 audits of various federal funds, COVID era federal funds programs. And so there's also, you know, existing audits in those places.
Great, thank you. And so this is roughly around the $13 billion that the state received.
Madam Chair, this slide is in reference to, if we think back to slide four, to the biggest box of flexible funds, the $4 billion managed by the by Minnesota Management and Budget.
Got it. Terrific. Thank you so much. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So back on page 12 or slide 12, when you say clean audit reports, I initially thought you meant the OLA, but who exactly performed those audits for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Rarick, the single audit is prepared by the state auditor.
And Madam Chair, yes. Representative Rarick, I would just add that the single audit we put out for RFP. It used to be done by the OLA. They declined to do that, and so we put it out for an RFP, and the state auditor is the person, the entity who currently has the winning bid for that RFP, and so has done it for the last several years.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, okay, so the state auditors, so let me ask this then. So since the state auditor's jurisdiction is local governments, what's the nexus between these funds that we're talking about on slide 12? Do they all go to local government? Is that okay? Maybe you could just differentiate that for us.
Commissioner Campbell.
Madam Chair, Representative Rarick, in this case, the audit is about, again, we'll get you the scope of what's included in the single audit, but it's state government federal funds that have been, I think it's grant. State grants, and so grants made with federal funds, and it is not. I would encourage you to not like consider the nexus with local government because it is much broader than that.
Okay.
Alden,
one more question.
Oh, Representative Rick.
Great. One more question. So back on slide 11, in our work here at the Fraud Committee, we've had quite a bit, and in fact, some of it hasn't even been public yet because we've been talking to whistleblowers almost weekly. Well, I think between the chair and myself weekly, and a few other members too, have been listening in on some whistleblowers within state agencies. And their great concern, one of their great concerns, I'll say, is listed on slide 11, which is the home and healthcare-based services. So we've had multiple whistleblowers concerned about fraudulent activity within those. Can you just tell us about, especially during the COVID era, what was done to prevent fraudulent nonprofits or nonprofit-like entities? We've also heard that there's LLCs that are kind of a shell that have formed. So can you just tell us about those kind of stopgaps that you've used on specifically those funds?
Mr. Campbell or Ms. Mingy, either one.
Chair Robbins and Representative Rarick, I think that we would probably need to follow up with our colleagues at the Department of Human Services to get you that information. I'm not sure that we have that information with us here today.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing from, again, Ms. Gandhi. So.
I'm sure she'll come back. Representative Hudson, then Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm interested in just kind of trying to understand contextually from a big picture what these kind of relationships look like between the federal government and the state when you're getting and this is probably unprecedented, the amount of subsidy that we got all at once during the COVID era. I mean, $76 billion, that's billions of dollars more than the state budget that we passed in the last biennium. And so the impact of that upon state and local government operations, particularly when it does start to taper off, which presumably everybody knew at some point it was going to, right? A lot of this is one-time spending. You mentioned this situation with the temporary restraining order and the funds that were attempted to be clawed back, and that one of the impacts you cited was 170 staff members who had to be laid off given the uncertainty of what's going to happen going forward. What was the plan from the start? Like, at some point, the money wasn't going to be there anymore. So when you're bringing on, in this case, 170 people, knowing that the work is likely to be temporary, is there any sense of, is there any plan to wind it down or to cut, or to land the plane, so to speak? Or is the presumption that somehow, some way, we were going to keep the funding going?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think for a more detailed explanation, I want the Department of Health to come share that with you. I would say in general, the plan was that these funds would expire in June of 2026, so it was about 15 months early, and that over the course of those 15 months, there are ways for state agencies to manage through more closely through things like staff attrition or reassigning staff to other projects. MDH in particular has a lot of evolving federal funding streams. So it was the abruptness and the fact that we received a notice on a Tuesday that was effective the previous Monday that made this particularly disruptive. But for more detail, we can connect you with the Department of Health.
Thank you, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. So is that, you're telling me or suggesting that that's kind of the standard practice of how these things work, that when there's one-time spending, if it involves the hiring of staff, there is some sort of a plan to, through attrition, wind staffing down over a period of time to make it a softer hit? Is that just a standard practice, or do we have enough experience with this sort of transition to even say that there is a normal way of doing it?
Ms. Minky.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the practices vary from state agency to state agency. In some cases, agencies hire more temporary positions, and in other cases, agencies hire permanent positions. In this case, there was sort of a blending, but it is something that happens from time to time that the different agencies manage differently, but so that different agencies manage it differently. It is not totally out of the norm to have one-time federal dollars, but I would, for the specific plans for the Department of Health, I'd want to make sure that they're able to answer that for you.
And Ms. Campbell.
Chair Robbins, Representative Hudson, I would just say that there are a number of different ways in which agencies can manage these types of situations. So it might be not filling behind vacancies. It might be that they begin to reduce staff over a period of time. It might be that they reduce services over a period of time. We would expect that agencies are preparing for those moments as they can. This, as Budget Director Minky said, was a little bit unexpected. But there are, I would say, agencies do have some tools in their toolbox in order to have a softer landing.
Yeah. One more, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of related, but a little bit of a topic shift. So you've mentioned, or you pointed out in your presentation, that a lot of these funds were earmarked, per se, for certain time periods to do certain things. Presumably that means that this time period, 5 years later, was thought out way in advance. Was any rationale ever provided for that we are anticipating that these emergency funds are going to be required for years and years and years down the road?
Ms. Minky.
Madam Chair, Representative, these federal funding bills had, trillions of dollars invested in them, and not all of them were, I would say, for specific emergency response. Some of them had much broader uses. So, for example, these grants from the CDC at the Department of Health, they were could be used on more specific COVID response, but also had allowable uses for things like strengthening state and local public health capacity. And so I think I obviously can't speak for Congress, I think the allowable uses in the grant program certainly are broader than the COVID health emergency in particular, which I think aligns with the vision of a longer expenditure period.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a few questions, and they're probably a get back to us questions, but just to note, and on the question of the sort of the broader uses of the COVID funds, some of them, and as we think about it, right, we're still dealing with the impacts of COVID, whether it's the public health question, the small business question, the impact on individuals, the mental health crisis that we have. I hear about it from businesses that are recovering, employers that are recovering, people who lost that period of a year or two of work. So as we think about it, I think it was wise for the federal government in 2020, 2021, to understand the magnitude of the crisis required not just directly responding to and getting folks tested in the vaccine, dealing with the time when folks couldn't be in school or their businesses, but also the long-term impacts that I think are going to be reverberating through the economy and our public health system and, frankly, our schools for decades. So I think when we think about the clawing back of these funds, what it is saying is coming back, going back on the commitment to the long-term recovery from the pandemic and as we get through it. And we're only, you know, 2 or 3 years on the other side of the vaccine. So that being said, you know, we're talking about, especially in this flexible funds, funds that went, I think, if I'm understanding correctly, funds that were sort of administered, some through local government, some through private providers, some through nonprofit providers, some directly to individuals, at least in the $76 billion number, which is a lot and a lot of different pathways. And it's a lot of different pathways that went to directly support people. And I'm wondering if it's hard, we're talking a lot about the dollars, and I know that that's because you're MMB and that's your job is to talk about the dollars. And so I know you don't have this at your fingertips, but I do think it would be worth when we talk about these programs and we talk about the audits of the programs to talk about the services and the people that they provided. So when we think about PPE and long-term care and hospitals, when we think about housing supports for folks who were facing eviction, childcare. My sister was a frontline worker. She was a nurse during that period, and so childcare staying open was partially as a result of these funds. And then she worked in long-term care. It served clients. She works with in geriatrics. So seeing really the difference between when the investment came in with PPE, when the investment came in to support birth nurses and nursing assistants, that was life-saving. And so I think when we talk about these dollars, it would be helpful to, as we move forward, make sure we're talking about the people, the programs, and the providers that the funding went through, because I think that will give us, as we think about oversight, a much clearer picture of the mammoth effort that is represented here in these numbers.
Thank you. First, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So during the course of this session, when this committee has met, we've talked a lot about fraud prevention. We've talked a lot about the policies that were in place. And a lot of times, it comes back to your agency as being the major stopgap. Every different agency has their own different set of rules, regulations in order to prevent fraud. And so when we're thinking of the vast amount of money that went through the state of Minnesota, whether directly from MMB to local units of government, whether to other state agencies, what of your fraud prevention measures were used on things like the rental assistance that was provided or the frontline pay? What of your procedures would have been used during that period of time?
Commissioner Campbell.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, MMB provides a central source of policies and procedures around both on the finance side and on the human resources side. Agencies need to implement those policies and procedures. We also have our internal controls unit, which is a team of five people. They help agencies make sure that they're doing risk assessments, making sure that they set internal controls, making sure that they're following up on OLA reports, but they do not do that work for them. And so it's really like in all instances, we provide a framework and assistance to agencies, technical assistance to agencies, and it is up to individual agencies to implement policies, make sure they've got good internal controls in place that are reasonable for whatever programs they are implementing, and making sure that they are doing the legwork associated with whatever those policies and procedures and internal controls are.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's take DLI and MHFA as an example. Through the last few years, to what extent has your agency gone to ensure that they are following your recommendations and ensuring that we're not seeing fraud in their spaces?
Commissioner Campbell.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, as I said, in all cases, we set the policy and provide technical assistance to agencies as they need it. These are agencies that have teams of financial management. They've got internal control and audit staff. And we expect that we help them understand what the policies are, we create the policies, and that they come to us as they need assistance.
Any further follow-up? All right. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm back on slide 12 trying to understand this. And you kind of caught my ear when you said you put out an RFP for these audits. I have two questions. So who in the state has capacity to do such audits? Because you said the OLA kind of turned you down to do this, and so it was awarded to the state auditor. So who in the state has the capacity to even do such an audit? And secondly, of these two funds, so ARPA and the CRF funds, how much are we talking about in total?
Commissioner Campbell.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, I'll defer to State Budget Director McGee on the total. What I would say is that the single audit is not just the COVID-era funds. It is a much broader subset of federal funds. The single audit is something that we do every year. And I think that there probably are a limited number of entities in the state who could do the single audit, but it's been a couple of years since we put out that RFP, and I think we could follow up with you and get you just some information on responses and qualified entities, some of that information. I don't have that handy.
Thank you. Representative Rick?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so now you've really got my curiosity going, unfortunately. So these single audits, maybe I need more understanding of what these single audits are, and you said you do them on a regular basis. So do you always put out RFPs for these types of audits, or is this, help me understand the auditing process? And there can't be that many folks in the state of Minnesota that have the capacity to do billions of dollars of deep audits like this. And kind of what are you looking at these audits? Because when I talked to the OLA, I used to work in accounting, and so we talked about some of this stuff. I had clients and I helped them go through sales tax audits and a few other things, and worked in nonprofits and went through audits. And so I have some capacity to understand. So if you would explain what exactly you're looking at, because when I talked to the auditor, I said, okay, so you look at these buckets, but you don't look at these buckets at all. And the not looked at buckets were way more interesting to me. For example, the nonprofit nonprofits that receive grants. Nobody looks at the salaries or how much grants they're getting from other state agencies. That's not even looked at by anybody. So then I said, okay, I should probably look at that. So what is looked at, what isn't looked at? And can you just walk me through just a little bit of these audits and what happens?
Commissioner Campbell.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick. So the single audit is required by the federal government, and it's looking at financial and compliance report on federally assisted programs, and it includes all federal assistance expended by state agencies that are determined to be part of the state of Minnesota's primary government. And so I think you're probably right about the number of entities that are available to do this type of work. I just don't have that information handy, so we will follow up with you on that piece. So we're looking at sort of like the big functions of state government that are federally funded. MMB doesn't determine that. That's determined both by the federal government and then by the auditor. And so there's a process that they go to decide what's in scope and what isn't. And so we actually just got the single audit back relatively recently. And so again, with clean unmodified, and so we could provide you for years, if you'd like, the single audits what their findings have been. I'm not sure. I think that in order to get a lot more detailed, we'd need team members from MMB who are really closest. They'd be on the financial reporting and the counting side of our agency to come in. We could come and sit down and talk to you if you'd be interested in understanding that a little bit better.
Representative Eric.
Absolutely. I would absolutely like to see the process. So if the state auditor is working with the federal government to decide what is in and what is out of the audit, that there isn't like a standard boilerplate kind of this is what we look at, I would definitely like to see that. And any reasons why certain things are put in or left out, I definitely want to see that. I want to see all the, you know, the process of reconciliations. Really important. Make sure that they are actually reconciled properly to the, right? You know, is it to the level where you're actually looking at what would be considered like source receipts? You know, how deep are we going? Are we just looking at, there's all kind of levels of audits, right? So I really like to look at that and see that because, when you first talked about it and you said you had clean audits, I just assumed, the OLA must have been doing it. I had no idea that you have this other process. I don't live in the land of Health and Human Services, so this is interesting and a little concerning, I think. But I'd like to learn more. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I think we'll wrap it up. I have one last question for myself, and then we'll invite your colleagues from DEED to come up. So when you were on slide 5, you were talking about how under the CRF funds, it was sort of the federal guidelines that they were expenses that were necessary because of the pandemic that had not previously been budgeted for. And I think that's an important caveat. But then in later discussions, you talked about how, well, but there's also really broad use of the grant money. And we used it for capacity building. And we used it to do different things that will have ongoing costs. So what I'm trying to figure out is how much of this extraordinary amount of money that came into the state was really used for one-time things, and how much of it has now created future obligations that, you know, was one of the reasons we're looking at a deficit. So I'm wondering if when you're doing the forecast, when you're doing all these things, of all the increase in Medicaid amounts, increase in spending for schools, capacity building in agencies with tech and other things, how much of what was really intended to be one time, even if it was an extended use out to 2026, it was still roughly one time, how much of that is really creating ongoing obligations to the state, and how can we quantify that?
Madam Chair, I'd say in general, the funds have paid for, the federal funds are sort of set aside from the general fund forecast. And so the forecast doesn't assume the continuation of these programs. They're not in agency-based budgets. There are some programs that have been enacted since these funds have expired to, because we learned about how effective and valuable they are. I would offer as an example, I talked about childcare stabilization grants in Minnesota. Relative to some of our peers, preserve childcare providers because we both leveraged the federal resources and then in later legislative sessions appropriated ongoing general fund supports through things like the provider Great Start compensation payments, which is now a state program, but that is something that was incorporated into the general fund projections now several years ago. So the funds provided one-time support, and then to the extent the legislature has chosen to make those permanent through general fund dollars, that's in the forecast, but by and large that hasn't happened. As we've discussed in other venues, the drivers of the deficit we're facing are really more long-term spending and revenue trends and are separate from the end of significant COVID funding.
Thank you. That's very helpful. So just to be clear, the federal $77 billion or whatever isn't on the general fund ledger. It's completely separate. And so it shouldn't be impacting at all the $6 billion deficit. So how do we square that then when, for example, the grants are cut off early and staff is being cut or providers are being told they won't have this money available? It's not on the books at all for the general ledger, for the general fund?
Madam Chair, if you think about the state budget is over $100 billion when you look at all funds.
Right.
Federal funds is about a third of that, but those are accounted for separately from the state general fund. And the general fund forecast incorporates our obligations, under state law for general fund funded programs.
So this would appear in the all funds, but not in the general fund. Got it. Okay, and then one more question. When you say you don't monitor how agencies are complying with policy, you just put the policy out there. When all this money came in, did you provide policies for the agencies to understand, like, you're getting this much money for this 2 or 5 year period, and how help them, to Representative Hudson's question, help them understand the difference between ongoing money and their responsibility there versus one-time money? Because my sense is a lot of this was then turned into ongoing obligations. Is there any breakdown you could send us for what was the one-time money that came in from the feds and how that is now being seen in ongoing obligations, because the legislature said so, but like it's created ongoing obligations? Because if it was really all one-time money, it shouldn't be that disruptive to know it's winding down, but it seems like it's very disruptive.
So, Chair Robbins, we can follow up with additional information. I would say that, again, in this case, The agency, I would argue, did not have the chance to wind it down because they expected to have those funds for well over a year. In this case, the funds, they received notification on a Tuesday that as of the previous Monday, the funds had been turned off. And so, I think that is a unique circumstance, I guess, is what I would say. Certainly, agencies.
I'm sorry, if I can just interrupt. So then of the money that's supposed to expire on September 30th or December 30th of this year, we know that money's winding down. How are they preparing for that? I just feel like we haven't really had a solid answer on what steps are they taking to end those obligations because they know it's winding down. For what policy guidance are you giving them?
So, Chair Robbins, what I would say is well, the conversations that we are having with agencies are about making sure that they have a plan in place to wind down, making sure that they have adequate resources to pay for all of the close down costs. There are costs associated with layoffs, severance, all of those sort of things. I think that we would have to get a little bit more information on how many employees are actually supported by this versus how the services that are supported. Those are really two separate things in terms of how we are talking to, and if it's just money out the door to Minnesotans, that's obviously important, but that's more of a communication around how we talk to communities who are impacted by that, what they can expect from us, and then in the event that there are employees that are supported by those resources, that is a situation where we really have to be thinking about how we're tapering down to a soft landing. Those are the conversations that we're having with them right now, asking them to do those risk assessments and making sure that they have a sense of a plan in place to so that it is not so abrupt, so that even if it is unexpected, that they have done a little bit of planning in that space. But generally speaking, I would say agencies do know, and this is regardless of federal funds or not, because there are also state funds that are appropriated on a short-term basis all the time. Agencies know that that if they're hiring short-term, that you know we have options in place, like a temporary unclassified employee position, for example, which is a three-year appointment or less. So if the funds are short term, then they might hire in that category as opposed to a permanent employee position. They might hire contractors. There are a variety of ways in which agencies handle that. And generally, I would say that understanding or knowledge is not new to state agencies. They generally have an understanding of how to work in a space where there are limited, short-term, limited resources available to them. And agencies have been historically managing in situations like this, you know, for a very long time.
Right. I appreciate that, because what I'm hearing in some of the other committees I serve on is that a lot of the one-time requests, they're coming, even though we all knew it was one-time money for various things, they're coming back and asking for ongoing appropriations. And so it doesn't feel like culturally that's been communicated well. Like a lot of this was one-time money, and I'm very worried about the increases, the plus-ups for, as you talked about, the Medicaid eligibility. That's, unless people really fully understood that was for a temporary period, that's going to cause a lot of problems for providers, for patients. And if people built capacity, because we did a lot of capacity building, assuming that would never go away, now what are we, why did we invest in all this capacity building when it was one-time money that we knew would end, and now people have all this capacity and there's no money? So I feel like maybe there were mistakes made. Even if there was the flexibility for capacity building, we overbuilt this capacity and the money's gone. And now people are coming back to us in all our committees saying, oh, but we need this to be ongoing. We need this. And I don't honestly fault them. It's like we created this problem and are pulling the rug out from under them. So I have deep concerns about this from the budget conversations I'm in other committees. So I just think we have to do a better job as a legislature and as the agencies communicating to people like this was never intended to be ongoing. And to the extent we encourage capacity building without any foundation, knowing the money would go away, that's a grave mistake on our part. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the testifiers. Just a chance. I guess just following up on that last piece, Madam Chair, I want to hear from the testifiers on this. I mean, I recognize the funding was one time, but of course there are ongoing community needs. There was the talk about childcare, for example. I'm very familiar with that. We kept that sector in much more stable than many other states because of the funding that was received. Are there other examples that you have? I'm just trying to make a distinction here, where the fact that there's a request coming back for ongoing funding, to my mind, is an indication that actually we've identified an ongoing need. Can you just sort of comment on that, as opposed to, I guess, that other point about, you just talk about meeting that those kinds of needs.
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, there are, as I think about the magnitude of things that we funded with the COVID relief dollars, there were certainly a lot of things funded with COVID funding where we identified a community need. I think there were put to things like some educational things, like multi-tiered systems of support, we learned was a sort of a really effective tool for our schools that then was followed by sort of more conversation at the state legislature and state dollars, things like shelter funding. There were huge gaps in the shelter system, and we sort of support some of those through COVID dollars, and it really highlighted some ongoing needs. Similarly, I think food support is another good example that I would bring up.
Thank you. And Chair.
Thank you. Last question. And then I know some of our colleagues have other questions, but I really need to get to the deed presentation. So if you can hold those questions till after deed, and then if you can stick around, we'll try and figure it all out at the end.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Robbins. So I think that's a really important point, is that the one-time funding does not mean that it was a one-time need. In fact, we identify there's ongoing needs. But the other distinction that I want to make, or just to understand, is the difference between one-time funding that's sort of scheduled to run out, and I guess I was hearing you talking about the current volatility at the federal level affecting things. That, you know, it's one thing to sort of know well in advance that funding will be running out, even if there's an ongoing need. It's another thing to have, you know, funds impounded unexpectedly or contracts broken. Can you just talk about sort of the challenge in dealing with that and the distinction between those things? I guess I'm trying to figure out sort of how you can even plan around that when there's that level of kind of chaos going on.
Commissioner Campbell.
Chair Robbins, Representative Pinto, I would say that lack of predictability is a real challenge for agencies to plan around. I think that it's been eye-opening in the last couple of weeks here, and I think agencies probably have more urgency around trying to plan for this work. It's hard to do when you've been given resources and are expected to do something, and also at the potentially for, you know, quite a long period of time yet, and also at the same time needing to be scaling that work down. We want to make sure that agencies and employees have as much that we can tend to that work as carefully as possible, so that there it isn't so abrupt, so people have more ability to plan, whether it's employees or community or the agency themselves, and just when resources are expected to last until a certain time and then they're suddenly gone, certainly that sort of upends work. And I can tell you, you know, at MDH, really, you know, for the entire agency, sort of through, it became an all-encompassing task for them for several weeks and continues to be, and for a lot of our colleagues, and so.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony today. I'd like to invite the Commissioner of Deed and his team to come on up. And if you wouldn't mind hanging around, we may have additional questions for you. Thank you. Excellent. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. My name is Evan Rowe. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I see many members of the Jobs Committee here, House Workforce. Sorry, that's the other body. But since not everybody on this committee is a member of the House Workforce Committee, I'm going to start my presentation just with a little bit of a primer on UI. For contextual benefit. So the basic policy, as contained in Minnesota statutes, is, you know, the public good is promoted by providing workers who are unemployed through no fault of their own a temporary partial wage replacement to assist the unemployed worker to become reemployed. Now, those words are important in the context of the Minnesota UI statute. It's an eligibility-based program. They must be, you know, primarily laid off. Although in the case of a quit or a discharge where the worker did not cause their own unemployment, they may be eligible. It's a temporary program up to 26 weeks, but we will talk a little bit more about that during economic downturns. Partial wage replacement, it's about half of the weekly wage up to a statutory maximum, which currently is $914 per week. And then the purpose is to become reemployed. So a person must be able to work, available for work, looking for work, or something substantively similar, such as training. But I think something that will be a kind of important note as we go through our presentation and conversation today is that unemployment insurance is a federal-state partnership. It was created by the Social Security Act of 1935. And while states have flexibility to adjust certain program parameters, they don't have flexibility on all of them. States must conform to federal law. They must administer the program in compliance with the federal guidance. And administrative funding is federal and conditional upon that conformity and compliance. And again, as we go through, during recessions, the federal government will frequently create additional or extended benefit programs, the purpose of that to be promoting economic security in difficult times. So UI is multiple benefit programs in one. Always on are, you know, what you might call regular UI, and then there's a variety of other kind of, I don't want to say ancillary programs, but related programs. There's combined wage, so if you have unemployment in multiple states, there's a mechanism for kind of interstate coordination. There's unemployment compensation for both federal employees and ex-service members. Those are administered by the state, but they are funded by the federal government and require participation from the federal government on significant parts of the workflow. And then there's trade readjustment allowance. Periodically, generally in the case of an economic downturn, you'll have a variety of additional or extended benefit programs that are meant essentially to either extend the duration of unemployment compensation when additional work may not be available for somebody seeking to reenter the workforce, and at times there will be additional kind of supplemental payments provided to increase the amount of kind of a weekly benefit amount that's available. Those are generally, though not always, federally funded. So the state will do the work, but the federal government will pay the cost. And what we'll talk about today, for some good amount of time, are the pandemic-specific programs. You may have heard of some of these acronyms or programs, but pandemic unemployment assistance, pandemic emergency unemployment compensation, and then there were a couple pieces of additional benefit payments that increased the value of benefits available during the pandemic. So going into the details a little bit more, as I think we all might, just to kind of set a little bit of context, there was a federal choice made in early 2020 to use the unemployment insurance system nationwide as an emergency response. There was a massive surge in layoffs. There was a need for economic assistance for tens of millions of Americans. And the federal government didn't really have tools to deploy funds at scale. So the decision was made by policymakers, both in 2020 and in 2021, to run a large amount of federal assistance through state UI programs. Now, there is now, as I mentioned earlier, it's a federal-state partnership. There is, national federal law that pertains, but there are 53, and that number is not in error because American Samoa, Puerto Rico, and the District of Columbia have unemployment insurance systems, but 53 individual administrative bodies that will run these programs. And just to, as a reminder, just in terms of how stark some of the, the kind of surge in unemployment insurance requests was, this is the Great Recession, which many of us probably remember in 2009. Just juxtapose the kind of a number of claims with what we saw during initial claims with what we saw during the pandemic. What we really saw was, an 8, 9, 10x increase in initial pandemic claims. And, I would say that as far as Minnesota's response goes, we were one of the first states that was able to roll out many of these federal programs. I will go into more detail as to why that might have been. But just by the numbers, right, because I think it's important to remember what this actually meant in terms of kind of just volumes so that committee members have kind of that context. Right, we had about 1.3 million applications for benefits, and 873,000 Minnesotans received at least one payment, which is a pretty stark number if one remembers that the state has about 5 million people. About $14.8 billion in total payments, and that's in contrast with about $800 million in 2019. Now, most of that money was federal. About $10.4 billion of it was federal. The state paid for the other component. And again, just to contextualize that, that's about 353 million bags of groceries. That's about 18 million rent payments, right? So this was a critical lifeline for Minnesotans as they confronted the economic challenges of the pandemic. So let's go into a little bit more detail on the specific programs that were created under the federal law. So there were three base programs that were created, and what I mean by a base program is sort of, it's a program that would make one eligible for unemployment insurance kind of at the time of application. We'll get into supplemental programs which would extend one's eligibility. So the first was pandemic emergency unemployment compensation that provided extended benefits following the exhaustion of regular UI and PEUC, because that is PEUC. That program was primarily intended for folks that they had perhaps filed for unemployment in 2019, and then, you know, as they confronted the challenges of unemployment caused by the pandemic, they were going to run out of weeks of benefits. This basically was a federal program that allowed folks to continue to collect benefits so that they could continue to make their rent and put food on the table. Extended benefits basically is the next tranche of benefits that provided extended benefits following exhaustion of both the regular UI and PEUC. And then there was a new program that was created called Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. And that was a new eligibility program that was limited to 2020 and 2021 for applicants who weren't eligible for regular UI. Generally, that would have been somebody who was self-employed or an independent contractor, but they became unemployed and lost their income due to the pandemic. That was a new program that was created for the purposes of pandemic relief. There were supplemental programs created as well. So these would basically be add-ons to an initial unemployment insurance claim. Lost wages assistance, supplemented benefits in regular UI, PUA, PEUC, or extended benefits. And that would have been an additional $300 a week that for an applicant that was eligible for the base program that ran through fall of 2020. Federal pandemic unemployment compensation, FPUC, supplemented benefits in those programs. At first it was $600 a week, later it was $300 a week, again for each week that one was eligible for a base program. That program ran a little bit longer, basically from the end of lost wages assistance through fall of 2021. And then there was mixed earner unemployment and compensation. So that was a $100 weekly supplement, and that was kind of only available for some of the self-employed individuals who were forced to go onto a smaller UI account. So they had some UI eligibility, but they weren't eligible for PUA. That was meant to be a kind of a bridge program, I think, to help with economic support there. And then there were a few other pieces where the feds reimbursed the state of Minnesota for policy changes that ordinarily would not pertain. So normally, unemployment insurance has a waiting week. You must wait 1 week prior to receiving your first benefit. That was waived during the pandemic, and the federal government picked up the tab on that. Additionally, there was, generally speaking, in Minnesota, nonprofits and instrumentalities of government may choose to be reimbursing employers to the trust fund rather than tax-paying employers. So they pay on a dollar-for-dollar basis back what they incur in UI expenses. The federal government paid for some level of the relief of those charges back to employers. They also paid for shared work. So I think folks probably remember that many states struggled in terms of delivery of services as it related to unemployment insurance. Now, there's a few reasons for that. I think part of that is that states are required to implement the federal programs in conformance with those federal US DOL instructions. That guidance was often slow to come during the pandemic. But I think the kind of proximate reason for a lot of these challenges was that many states had historically failed to update their business processes and their technology systems in the run-up to the pandemic. That led to a lot of delays and errors. I picked a Florida headline here, but you could choose many states around the country where that was the case. I would say that was not the case in Minnesota. And I think it's worth noting that good business process reinforces program integrity. So part of the reason why Minnesota has historically invested in again, good business process, improving our technology stack, is that Minnesota's always been a very seasonal state for UI. You know, we have a lot more claims in the winter, you know, when, you know, oftentimes construction and those industries kind of wind down during the winter. That means that we've always had to sort of surge our volumes, which doesn't lend itself to solving a problem with people. It lends itself to solving a problem with better business process and technology that can scale. So that means we built our program to scale up in busy season. You know, in the pandemic, that was, you know, I could probably add 100 varies to this statement. You know, it was a very, very, very busy season. But it didn't actually require our program to break our existing management processes or controls. And that wasn't the case in other states. You heard examples probably of some states where they were trying to manage certain UI programs using things like Google Forms. That was never the case here in Minnesota. It ran through the UI processes, and we were able to adjudicate in line with the normal way that we manage this program. I want to talk a little bit now about sort of a couple of the different vectors for kind of potential integrity risks in unemployment insurance programs. The first is cybercrime. And there's really kind of two buckets of this. One is what we'd call account imposters. Those are when, you know, a fraudster will create an account using a stolen or a synthetic identity to file a fraudulent UI claim. So they'll pretend to be Evan Rowe filing for the first time, and then, you know, they'll try to direct the payment to their bank account. So they'll use, you know, PII that's been obtained from data breaches or social engineering to try to get a claim. Another type of cybercrime is account hijackers. So that's where a cyber criminal might take over an existing UI account that somebody already has by stealing login credentials through phishing or malware or credential stuffing. It's, you know, you get a text message saying that, you know, your UI claim is pending, and they take you to a spoof site to do that. They'll do that to redirect the benefit payments, to change the contact information, or to lock out legitimate users. And again, you'll see that if you get an unauthorized password change of direct deposit details, and the like. Here in Minnesota, you know, this is, I think, general best practices for these types of programs. But what types of controls do we have in place? Obviously, identity verification and change monitoring, right? You verify IDs with authentication. You use a variety of data analytics tools to monitor for suspicious patterns. And you validate the data and do cross matches with what you have. You also have to kind of keep an eye on threat monitoring and anomaly detection. So analytics to detect suspicious patterns, monitoring of various web analytics tools. And then it's about account protection and recovery. Some of that's just, you know, upgrading and making sure that you've got good processes for those pieces. It's also a bit of education. Things like saying the UI program will never text you. So please don't text somebody back if you get a random text from somebody that you don't know. Misrepresentation is a different vector. Now, this occurs when an applicant or an employer knowingly makes a false statement or representation, they deliberately fail to disclose material facts on an application, or they knowingly withhold information to obtain or prevent the receipt of unemployment benefits. The types of controls that we have in place in Minnesota, you know, I think are, again, it's not one thing. You want to have multiple things here. It's confirmation of facts as represented. There's sort of a two-sided nature to the unemployment insurance system in that employers have an account and they can raise issues if they see something that isn't correct. We also will, you know, contact employers when somebody files a claim. So that is one vector to prevent bad actors from stating things that are not true. All records are appealable and can be taken up all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States if one takes it that far. There's a reporting portal, which I've included on the right just for visibility, and call center. We do get a number of tips through that way. We randomly audit cases, and then there are administrative and criminal penalties for people who are not, you know, who seek to take advantage of the program. Just in terms of the overall, the performance of the state, according to the Department of Labor, Minnesota has one of the lowest fraud rates in the country. That's why our state is green, not red. We have some of the highest pay and accuracy rates in the country, and we exceed federal standards on that front. And I would say that we substantially exceed federal standards on, you know, peer and federal reviewed benefit timeliness and quality audits. The program is reviewed frequently and extensively. In 2022, the OLA did a review of pandemic-related technology efforts and said, the UI division regularly conducts data analyses. These processes were effective in quickly identifying and locking the suspicious accounts in our sample. We make continuous investments in technical tools, improve business processes and monitoring. I would say that it is sort of a part of the program's DNA to continue to upgrade its capital stack and make sure that the technology there is available to support Minnesotans now and into the future. And the program is reviewed by multiple agencies each year, including the IRS, Social Security Administration, third-party information technology officers. We're part of a single audit, so it is highly reviewed, and we work really hard to address items that may come up. That's a quick overview of some of the work of the program, and happy to take any questions, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you very much. Representative Rarick, did you have a question or no?
I'm sure I will.
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought your name was on the list. Okay. Well, I will be the first to start. First of all, thank you for your work. And I remember when the unemployment program was announced and the scrambling that was going on to make sure benefits got out there. And I know it was a big lift for the DEED team. So thank you for your work on that. So I don't know really how to square the circle. I guess one of the things is the OLA report was very focused on just the two areas that you identified about the imposters and the hijackers. And they noted in their report that they did not evaluate DEED's efforts to prevent or detect fraud committed by employers or individuals who misrepresent their eligibility. So that report, while it was very good, was also very narrow. And so I just want to reflect more on what they didn't look at, which is your efforts to prevent fraud committed by employers or individuals who misrepresent their eligibility. And the GAO report from the pandemic program, not the regular UI, showed that Minnesota had $26.3 million in overpayments. Of that, they recovered $2.9 million, and that's in the fraud category. In addition, non-fraud, just overpayments, was $55.3 million. Of that, they recovered $13.3 million. So clearly, when we're not just dealing with the narrow subset of imposters and hijackers, there was a huge problem in unemployment fraud. For just the pandemic program, the regular UI program in those same years also had in fraud $9.7 million in overpayments and in non-fraud $91.3 million in overpayments. So there is a huge situation going on with our ability to confirm eligibility. And as the auditor noted, they didn't really look at that. So could you walk us through more what you do specifically to detect fraud committed by employers or individuals who misrepresent their eligibility?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I guess I'll just start kind of by noting the bifurcation of sort of fraud and non-fraud overpayments, right?
Excellent.
Because I think that might be helpful for members. So, non-fraudulent overpayments do occur, right? And I think an overpayment is written when we learn something new about an applicant's file that might not have been true at the beginning. In most of those cases. It's an honest mistake by an applicant or an employer in some cases. And what happens in those cases is we will write an overpayment to the applicant's file. That overpayment will be recovered through, either kind of a reduction in their benefits as they kind of go forward, right? Somebody added a zero to an application element. It's, again, we want the greatest level of accuracy possible. At the same time, there are there is a tension between timeliness and, and complete accuracy, right? So for non-fraudulent overpayments, those are generally recovered through through administrative means through the program. Just to go back to, some of the controls on, what we'd call misrepresentation or fraud, right? I think these are the tools that the department uses to prevent, fraudulent vectors for claims. Now, again, I think to go into a little bit more detail, right? If you are an employer and you receive a letter, you will generally receive a letter in the mail, and you will receive a notification in your UI account if somebody is applying for benefits under the program. You then, as an employer, can raise an issue to the unemployment insurance division saying, hey, something isn't right here. This person is claiming UI, but I didn't fire them. They quit, or they did something to that effect. That will then kind of raise a fact-finding process, which will be adjudicated by the division, and then essentially, if either party disagrees with the outcome of that adjudication, they can appeal to a UI, to an unemployment insurance law judge, who will then review the facts of the case and then make a determination based on that factor. If they disagree with the decision of the UI judge, it can be appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and so on and so forth. So having a it's at first a quasi-judicial process that becomes a judicial process, right? So there is a vector for that to occur. Now, there are also incidences where we find that somebody did misrepresent the record. I can speak a little bit to some of the administrative penalties there. So if you knowingly misrepresented the facts of your when you were applying for benefits, the program charges will levy a 40% administrative fee on the value of the benefits that were received through misrepresentation, and we will work to collect those benefits and kind of get that back over time. For truly egregious cases, there are criminal penalties, and we have referred several dozen cases to county prosecutors for judicial action where it is warranted. Now, again, I think there's again a tension. County prosecutors have limited authority, so we do leverage those administrative functions significantly. And then I think another way in which we work to ensure integrity overall is through random audit. A sampling of UI cases are audited, kind of in a statistically significant manner, and we work and items that are caught there are worked to be remedied.
Thank you for that. So just to confirm, there was a lot of fraudulent and non-fraudulent overpayment in the pandemic unemployment account, and the recovered amounts were low. So on the fraudulent side, it was 26.3 million, and the recovered amount was 2.9 million. So when you go after it, is the recovery that you just try to get back the some of the benefit on a future claim, or do you actually go and try to get the money back?
Madam Chair, both. We do have tools in the unemployment insurance law that allows us to, that do allow us to levy liens and other kinds of and other tools to be able to effectuate that.
And how often is that used?
I'd have to follow up with the exact numbers, but we do use those tools that are at our disposal. And again, as I mentioned, we've referred, I want to say 60-odd cases to county prosecutors over the last few years. Again, I think in terms of misrep penalties, again, I'd have to get an exact number, but these are tools that the program has at its disposal and does use.
Great. I'll have more questions, but we'll go to Representative Schultz and then Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rowe, so when we're looking at Minnesota, the reports, if you just go to the news stories, suggest that between overpayments and fraud, that it was around $430 million. And then, kind of following this this line towards those who are overpaid. You know, the totals for that amount of money, not even specifically talking about fraud, but more so overpayments, would be around $367 million. So specifically, since those are overpayments, what amount of money has the agency been able to recover from the overpayments that were made?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I guess I am not sure which number you're quoting in terms of like that, the $300 million. I'm guessing you're referring to one of the OIG reports, if that's right, which if that is the case, I'll just note that those, I think, were estimates that the, you know, that the USDOL or the GAO, those were estimates that were made based on kind of sampling methods that were applied very broadly. As I recall, in the appendix of one of those reports, you know, I know the U.S. Department of Labor kind of raised some pretty significant concerns about the methodology of those reports and the way that those things were applied. I'm not trying to quibble, but I do think that those were estimates that don't reflect the actual values that the agency reported to the USDOL. I think they were estimates that were conducted by federal entities. And, you know, I do know of, you know, at least a few cases where some of the, you know, where some of the assumptions that were made by those federal, you know, kind of by some of those federal reviewers were not necessarily backed up by normal practice.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rowe, I find your comments a little bit quite concerning, actually, in part because I'm using the data, the federal data, and then I used AI and brought about these numbers in overpayments, okay? And I'm specifically looking directly at the payments that were because of mistakes by the claimer or the claimant and the employer, and that's how I got to that number. Then I will just say that I didn't hear an answer from you on how much money we've been able to recover from that group of people. So that's also concerning. The next question that I have for you here is that through this oversight, and you were questioning how they did this, yet this is the program that has been established for every state to do this. And you cited in this very presentation that you're proud of where Minnesota stands by comparison to the other states across the country. So it's got to be one or the other. You've got to either celebrate where Minnesota stands and believe in the data or not believe in the data. Because this is specifically from 1,400 people or 1,400 claims and an audit of 1,400 claims, of which the program was far larger than that, far more than 1,400 people received it. So just want to level set us here. But my question for you for the future, because we're here for the oversight and to make sure that we have the policies right, thinking about this Minnesota UI program, and I want to just kind of key in on vulnerabilities here. Can you share for us through this program or through the years that have passed since the time that these dollars were rolled out, who was it that identified the vulnerabilities and what actions have been taken or what should we as this committee or as legislators look to do to change the policies so that we're not seeing these rampant overpayments and to stop the fraud?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, thank you for clarifying. I just wanted to make sure I understood which, you know, there's a lot of different data sources out there, so I just wanted to make sure I understood which one you were referring to. So if you're talking about the one from, I think the one you're referring to that was kind of based on that, you know, sampling of, that's based on the sampling of cases, that's from, you know, a USDOL report called the Benefit Accuracy Measurement figure. So that's a business process metric, right? That is a way that all states all states kind of go through this, and it's used really, you know, you take each case, you know, I think in Minnesota they take about 400 cases each, you know, take about 400 UI files each year and exhaustively audit them, right? Like basically go down with a fine tooth comb and find like every small thing that might have gone wrong during one of those. And it's used in many ways for business process improvement and ways for the, and used as a way for state UI agencies to improve their overall performance. Now, the and because of that, right, the federal government has set a target for basically 10%, kind of a 10% metric. We comfortably beat that. I think ours, from memory, the last one was about 7.8%. So we are one of the top performing states on that front. And in Minnesota, most of those improper payments are due to applicant error. Now, again, when we identify those, we will hold the applicant overpaid, and we will be and we collect those overpayments back through benefits. Because again, these are not necessarily fraudulent issues. These are issues where an applicant in a well-intentioned manner, might have made a mistake on the process. So again, that's why the standard there is 10%. Minnesota comfortably exceeds that standard. To your point, to your second part of your question, though, I would say, overall, right? Like we have to maintain constant vigilance, I guess, is what. And I think I'm hoping this is responsive to your question, but in terms of identifying challenges and in identifying making sure that we are staying on top of kind of program integrity risks, that is work that never really ends for the program. And we're constantly upgrading our systems, we're constantly upgrading our processes to make sure that we are doing the very best the very best we can. And that's a responsibility that's shared at all levels of the program, from the division director and the team that manages the product to folks who are kind of on the front lines taking calls, working and adjudicating claims. It's kind of a shared responsibility across the agency, and it's something that the team takes very, very seriously.
Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I want to go to this question of the extended benefits, particularly for folks who are not eligible, like solo practitioners, independent contractors. That, am I right in that those benefits were they paid by the UI Trust Fund, or were they paid by the federal government?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, those were paid by the federal government. Pandemic, the PUA was entirely a federally funded program.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. And the reason I ask, which will not surprise you, is we've been doing a lot of work together on the issue of misclassification and when employers don't pay into the trust fund, when they misclassify their workers, they don't pay into the trust fund when they should, and both the trust fund goes down and also employees don't get the benefits unless there's an enforcement action. I'm wondering if that issue of misclassification, misrepresentation, is in any of these numbers in terms of the loss to the state of that kind of misrepresentation.
Mr. Bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, no. That is something that I think would need to be, calculated and assessed separately, which I know there are some considerations underway on that front.
Thank you. One more. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been waiting for 45 minutes on the list. So I am right that the federal government doesn't require us to track that. The state government doesn't require to track that. Right now, in our numbers, the issue of misrepresentation related to employer misclassification fraud is not in these numbers. And I'll just say, and I guess since we're wrapping up, there has been reports that it might be up to $200 million a year as a problem. We have a bill that's currently in jobs to measure the impact. I think that this is something I've started to work on the labor side, but in this fraud prevention space, figuring out how much government is losing from employer misclassification. It's the UI Trust Fund, it's the Workforce Development Fund, it's the tax relief, payroll taxes is a really important thing, and is something that potentially this committee should think about looking at. There's been reports on the outside, but because we don't require the state to track it, the federal government doesn't require the state to track it, both the OLA has recommended and I have a bill to make sure that we do, because we need to know how much the state is losing in misclassification fraud.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Real quick, I think in this discussion, it's important to acknowledge that anytime you're dealing with a statistical process, which we're doing here, it's literally impossible to completely eliminate all fraud unless you spend more money to to try and eradicate the fraud than the fraud that's occurring. I don't want to see us creating expectation that it's possible to get to zero fraud in programs like this, especially from where we are, where we're already one of the top states in the country in rooting it out. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there time? Representative Rarick, very quickly.
Okay, so instead of my question, I just want to make a quick comment. So in my over a decade of work with unemployment insurance and have gone and toured and talked and done your bills and all kinds of things throughout the years, I actually really appreciate what you've done. And I know, and to Representative Elkin's point, I would love to eliminate fraud completely and misrepresentations and all of that, and human nature is human nature. But what I'd like to look at is actually some of the processes that you actually have and the incredible technology that you have, and look at that to say maybe we need to duplicate some of these processes. And so as I'm kind of listening to you and remembering the depth, and literally claims go as far as, administrative law judge, and you have to have response from the company and so on back and forth. And so I'm thinking about maybe we should apply some of this for like waived services and other places where we're seeing tremendous fraud. So I appreciate what you're doing. I only have, well, we're over time, so I'm not going to ask my question. I'll ask you offline. But thank you, Deputy Commissioner Rowe, and I really appreciate the work that you do and understand the complexities.
Thank you for coming. I also have follow-up questions, as does Chair Pinto. So one final comment, Chair Pinto.
Thank you so much, Chair. And I'm just going to note, and thank you, Commissioner. I clicked through. One of the slides talks about comparing us to other states, because that's come up. And I know the Trump administration has made a lot of changes to federal websites, but I went and they're still there, assuming that they're accurate there. Minnesota is in the top 10 in terms of payment accuracy and has one of the lowest fraud rates in the country. So we can be proud of the work of your agency. Thank you so much, Commissioner. There's obviously more to do. I want to make sure we recognize that. And compared to other states, I think we can be very proud. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And with that, members, we're adjourned. Mr. Rowe, I have several other questions I plan to follow up with you. Thank you. Sure.